So, now that we've started, let's continue with our introduction of conventions. As you were probably used to these productions as always enumerating your left-hand side and your right-hand side. And in this example, for our concrete program language, you've seen that it is convenient to have a lot of different alternatives for your production, and you introduce them with such an alternation symbol. So what you do in most cases for these program language relevant productions is you join them all into one when they have the same left-hand side, and always use them in such a normalized way. And yeah, in order to refer to certain alternatives, you just enumerate them one by the other. So introduce numbers for the alternatives, and in case you want to refer to one specific alternative, you just mention the left-hand side symbol together with the index of your alternative. Okay, so whenever you see something like this in the following, you will know this is pointing to a specific alternative production. Okay, so for the stuff that we will do further on, we will have an example grammar, which is, here's a few of them. And yeah, do these look familiar in some way to you? Does anyone know one of them, what they are doing? I should have mentioned that those two are meant to be different, probably, but you were referring to the lower one, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's one very famous one that acts with different levels in generating or, well, consuming expressions. And what it consumes is actual, yeah, I already said, it is expressions that are made up from, yeah, as you said, it was sums, and next level it would be something like products. And the idea is that, yeah, this task can be performed in multiple ways. The upper grammar is also doing the same thing with one major difference between those. And this is this hierarchy that you already had with these E's and T's, which means that in the lower one, there's something more special going on than in the upper one. The lower one already encodes the way that punctuation is, or this punctuation rule that multiplication and division is binding more strongly than the addition and the subtraction, and that with the brackets you can restart the whole hierarchy, and the upper one relies on external measurements to get the expression right. But apart from that, both of them would actually detect the same languages. Okay. Once again, with our convention, we would when we would refer to certain alternatives, we would use numbers. And for the next examples, we will use the grammar over here. So for the ones that have to keep them in mind, like myself,
for that.
No pens today. Yeah, I I will try to point them out to you if you are in doubt which one I mean. Just ask. I can tell you which one is meant when I do my indices. Okay. So the important thing that we have to talk about is the connection between the structure and the input that our grammars are or the automaton automata are consuming afterwards. Yeah, there's always a little bit of confusion going on with consummation and production. That depends on which side of your parser you're working on. When you're talking about grammars are mostly producing things, and the automata are consuming things. But these are go together hand in hand, so to say, conceptually. So it might be that I alternate between these two terms. But actually, I for the grammars, I always mean the production of your input, and for the stack machines, I always mean the consummation of the whole thing. So the derivation of a grammar is how the grammar produces the terminal string. And yeah, grammars are seen as term rewriting systems in the sense that that for sentence forms, for right-hand sides, each of the non-terminals can be rewritten into another term according to the productions that I have. And when I perform several of these rewriting steps, I will eventually, at the end, end up with a sentence form that's only made up of terminals. And things that can be produced with these terminal writing systems are our derivations. Well, in the examples that we had before, which belongs to the arithmetic expressions, well, we have the starting symbol E, and from this we can start such a sequence of rewriting, such a derivation. So let's do that for an example. So for the E, we will start with to produce a little bit of mass here. So let's start with the first alternative. I can make E plus T from that, and for the E, I can produce further on something like T. With the T, I can expand it once again to create something like a multiplication. Then I can choose, for example, another non-terminal. I don't always have to choose the first one. I can also rewrite something which is in the middle, which is this F. I can also make from the F something which is one of our token classes. So terminal, then I can choose the T. From the T, I can do once. Well, I can, for example, do another F, and for the F, I can once again create something terminal, which is in this case an identifier. And then the only choice that I have left is I can rewrite the T. I can do that into an F, and also the F into something terminal. So that is a typical way of rewriting. I did that kind of chaotically in this case. I chose like I wished to choose. For example, just at this case, I was choosing in the middle. This case was choosing at the beginning, so that was rather chaotic in this case. But that would be a valid derivation in our definition. Yeah. So more formally, I would introduce this derivation as with a derivation symbol here as a relation between words over non-terminals and terminals, or sentence forms, as you may like you may, and a valid derivation like this is a derivation when I pick a non-terminal in my sentence form on the left-hand side of this derivation relation and replace it with the right-hand side of a production that is in my set of productions. So you see, yes?
I said that you can't jump steps, for example, from a T get
that depends, and that's the next thing that I wanted to say, that actually only depends on how your production is, if you have the set of productions where this step from your T to the int directly mentioned, this is just one step and that's okay. If you have your example with no such production, this would strictly be not okay. But in most cases, when I talk of derivation, I always mean the transitive closure of the whole thing. So this means that I mean all the steps that are possible between those things. So in most cases, we will talk about derivations with the reflexive closure of one of these steps in mind. So, yeah. Okay. So, as you've seen, this relation, well, formally, it's not okay to use it like this. I would have to refer to a certain set of productions when I annotate this relation symbol here between a certain sentence forms, but for the sake of our examples, we mostly know which grammars we are talking of. So yeah, I'll leave them away. But strictly, these derivations are, of course, always related to a grammar. Yeah, for one of these derivation steps, well, as we've already seen, it's not a matter of where we rewrite or how we rewrite, it's just, that's not specified there. All of these things would be derivations. So now we can come to, as we have the syntax of grammars and productions, and as we have seen what a derivation is, we can now state what we mean when we create such a grammar. Which means that we can specify the language as the semantics of the grammar, and that's now pretty easy. The language that is produced by such a grammar is all the words that are made up from sequences of terminals that can be derived in arbitrarily many steps from the starting symbol of my grammar. So that is what it means when I specify such a grammar. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's just once again mentioning that the order is not so important for only the semantics of my grammar. Now that we know what the grammar actually means, is that we should that we have realized that the way that grammars are specified, there might be several ways to come to the sets to the sequences of terminals. So it's not fixed which steps in my terminal writing phase I choose. So I can freely choose which alternative I can use, and I can also freely choose which non-terminal I want to rewrite. So to get to something more unique. Probably this is just the plain semantics of grammars are not sufficient enough. So let's have a look at more detail what this derivation is made up from. So we will have a look at the specific derivation tree. Derivation tree is in contrast to just the plain sequences of sentence forms or symbol sequences. It is also important to have a look at which alternatives I choose. I chose. So for a derivation tree, I'm interested in kind of the sequence of alternatives that I used for rewriting the whole thing. And let's see whether this brings us more to something that we can use uniquely as kind of the thing that we specify with the production. And yeah, in the example that we have before, we have used kind of the alternatives that I've annotated here at the derivation steps. This leads to a certain way of deriving. And in order to make that more graphical, we can introduce this concept of a derivation tree. And such a derivation tree consists in, well, the specification of the alternative that I chose to rewrite with at first, and annotate the results that I got from that one level below, then make them into new derivation steps like this, and annotate the results below like this. Then I make these into, once again, into derivations like these, with results like this, and so on. That's how I can visualize these derivations trees. And looking at these, I can already see that the actual derivation tree is there's kind of special ways which of the derivation steps are actually having an influence on the produced terminal sequences, and which of them are not. And this depends on whether I do my derivations on the left-hand side or on the leftmost non-terminal or on the rightmost terminal. And depending on whether I do my, I can then kind of try to come to unique results in my derivation tree when I do that in a regular way. So when I always do the leftmost derivation, I will come to a certain kind of derivations. Or if I always do my rightmost derivations, I will also come to a kind of unique result in the whole system. And for example, for the derivation that we have seen so far, I can do kind of leftmost derivations that will end up in the sequence like this. I will at first do the derivation step at the top anyway. Then I will choose the left branch to do the next derivation step. Then here I don't have any choice. I will have to continue with the only child. Now I do once again the left hand side branch, which will lead to this derivation. Here I don't have any choice. This will lead to this one. Now I will continue with the next one that is not a terminal symbol, which will be the F, where I will do the derivation with the alternative 2. And then I have to continue with these two bushes. So that is a kind of depth first search once again, like we had already for the scanner. So that is what the leftmost derivation is kind of producing through the tree of derivations. And I can also do it the other way around, which is the rightmost derivations. Well, this is just going like this through the whole tree. And There's also the notion of something which is a little bit astonishing at the first moment, which is the reverse rightmost derivation. That is just the rightmost derivation from front to from back to front. So this is just the mirrored version of the rightmost derivation. And in terms of enumeration of our derivations in our tree, this would end up in, well, let's have a look at how this would look like. It would start with this one, going to the T1. And then before going to the subtree's root, it will have to come up with the other branch, which would be this one. Then it will, as it has treated both of the branches, it will be able to visit this one. Then we don't have any choice. We go one step up. Then once again, before going to the root of this subtree, we will visit at first this one, and this one, and at last the root. So derivation, which is this reverse rightmost derivation, that is the one that's also corresponding to the to a depth first search, which is descending to the right and then triggers its actions on the way back up. So that is what reverse rightmost derivation does. So it is a post depth first traversal through the whole thing. Okay. So having seen different possibilities that arise whenever you choose different concepts to make your derivations, we've seen that there's the possibility for ambiguous derivations depending on which way you try to reconstruct your derivations. So the things that we would really like to have is unique grammars for which there's no doubts, there's no ambiguities on what you can construct with that, no matter which strategy you choose. So for that we will I guess it's time to introduce a special name for what we call this sequence of terminals that is produced by our grammars. Well, we call the whole thing a yield, and we need that in order to define our unique grammars. The grammar is always then unique when there's maximally one derivation tree that yields each of the words that are emanating from the S, shields all the terminal sequences that are possible with this grammar. So, looking back at our examples that we had, there was two grammars offered. There was the upper one, which was just one level of kind of precedences, or used just one level of precedences, and turns out that the first one is producing several different derivation trees for a certain input sets. So there's major difference for major difference to the grammar below, which is one that that is not ambiguous, which means that it produces only one unique derivation tree, no matter how you choose to derive your productions. Okay, so this makes a kind of impact. conversation afterwards, because for certain grammars which are not unique, you won't be able to construct a deterministic parser. Okay. So in conclusion, our derivation tree is the thing that we want to use to represent the hierarchical structure. So you can think of the whole thing as, well, what we want to do is we want to come up with this derivation tree, and for each of the components in the derivation tree we will use one of the actions that we specified with our productions. And we can use these callbacks in order to produce the syntax tree. In a sense, well, you have seen either you go through the whole thing top down, and in each of these derivation steps you can try to construct your syntax tree, or you go the whole thing bottom up, or you can also try to assemble these small units of your syntax tree and then assemble them step by step when you ascend up to your root and construct the syntax tree with this way. So there's two notions: how your derivations can contribute to your syntax tree, which is the top down reconstruction or the bottom up reconstruction. Okay, so the next thing that we need for our parser is that we need to know something about pushdown automata. So let's talk a little bit about pushdown automata. A pushdown automaton is something that is closely related to context-free grammar. It's actually consuming the... Well, for each context-free grammar, you can find a pushdown automaton that consumes the input that the as input that what the context-free grammar produces. So, why do we want to have pushdown automata? Well, a pushdown automaton is something that we can implement quite easily with just tables that are used for state transition lookup, and that's something that is. It can be done quite generically with a kind of parser driver, which is just a kind of lookup in a table. Okay, so an example for pushdown automaton. Pushdown automaton has several components. In our example here, we have for states numbers. We always mark them with several roles. For example, there are start states, and there's also the concept of final states. And there's the next thing that we need for pushdown automaton is this transition table, where we can look up how we come from one state to the other while consuming the input. And in our pushdown automata here, we do not need to differentiate between pushdown symbol and states, so we assume that there's only states. There's only states on the pushdown, and our transitions directly work on the top of the stack, and rewrites the top of the stack in a certain way. So that's what these two columns of the table mean. So the rightmost symbol represents the thing that is on the very top of the pushdown represents our actual state, and a transition works like that: it has a look at the input and the top of the pushdown, and consumes both and produces a new top of the stack, which is in the last column. Okay. So, more formally, what we need for a pushdown automaton is, well, we need our specially marked states. Well, at first we need the whole set of states, then we need the start state and the final states. That's the ones that we have seen on the left-hand side on the last slide. And we need to specify what the input of our automaton looks like. That is the input alphabet T. And we also need to specify a finite set of transitions of our pushdown automaton. That's, yeah, that's a relation, which is of the components. Well, there's a non-empty string of states from the pushdown's top. There's the input that is consumed, which might also be, well, there might also be transitions that do not consume any input. And then our one of these transitions might produce an output that I want to place on top of the stack. So that's what the third component is for. Okay, and when we are talking about one of these pushdown automata, we will talk about computations, and in order to do that, we will talk about state of a pushdown automaton, and in order to capture the whole state in which one of these automata is in, we will need to have a look at the state and the input. So, well, actually, here that this is the complete content of the state, which is of the type several stacks symbols and or pushdown symbols, and there's also the second component, which is the remaining content of my input, which is of type several input symbols. Okay, so that is what our computational state looks like, and the example here, how would the automaton work? Let's have a look by observing one example input. Well, start state means that I will start with the start state on the stack at first, and I still have my input here on the side of the computation state. And now let the whole system run. That means what will the whole system do? Yeah, at first we will have to check the first two columns of our transitions. In this case, we will see that we can match. Yeah, that's the one that I have already circled in. But it's this one. This matches the zero on the stack, and the input we will find an A, which means this one. So the computational step in this case will be, well, we will replace the top of stack, which is the zero, with 1-1, and we will consume the A, so there's one A gone amiss here. So the next step in our computation would involve, well, we have to check the combination of the prefix of the input and the postfix of the stack. And actually the only thing that matches here is these two things here, which means that the top stack must be 1 and the consumed input would be A. So we remove this first input bit and replace the stack with we will add another 1 on there. And yeah, for next thing we will repeat the step. And now we will find this the situation where we cannot match with this rule anymore, because we don't have the combination of A and 1 in input and top of stack, because here's no A. So I will have to go for another transition, which is this one over here, where I find the B in the input and the 11 on the stack. So I will remove this one and replace the whole thing with a 2. Yeah, and now the only things that will match until the end of our run will be the combination over here. And it will once again produce the situation where we shorten the stack by 1 until we reach an empty input, which is for and on the stack 2 as our final symbol, which means that we have reached our end and decided to accept this input. Okay, so one of these computation steps can be characterized with a tuple of these computational states. So this will be the type, and a valid computational step is one that that whenever we consume an X here, we will have to modify the top of the stack according to a rule from our grammar, from our transition table. Sorry. Okay, so that is the computational relation which we can use to define the semantics of our pushdown automata. So that's what we are after once again. And once again, what we do is we take several of these computational steps together in the transitive hull, and we'll specify the semantics of our pushdown automaton by the sets of computations that we can do by starting from the initial state and the whole input. And we will only take those inputs into our semantical specification of what my pushdown does when we reach the final state or one of the final states and have consumed our input in this case. So that's what the semantics of a pushdown automata is. Yeah, and we can also for pushdown automata we have the same situation as for final automata. We distinguish between deterministic and non-deterministic ones, and the main criterion for us whether we have a deterministic pushdown automaton or not is, well, the only place where we can have non-determinism in is in deciding which of the transitions can be applied to this in this computational step, meaning this combination of remaining input and top of the stack. So we need to define our deterministic pushdown automaton in a way that this cannot happen, and that's what we do here. So what we need for a deterministic pushdown automaton is that the suffix of the stack has to be compared, and whenever in transition rules of our pushdown automaton, the there's a substring relation between the components lambda lambda 1 here. We are always interested in the cases where lambda 1 is a suffix of lambda 1 prime, because in these cases we will have a kind of suffix type intersection between two applications of transitions, and in these cases we need the consumed input to be different from each other, otherwise we would not be able to decide which of these transitions would be the ones that we have to take. So that is the situation that is not allowed to happen. In our case, the only place where we have the situation where these left components of our transitions are in a suffix relation is the one that I've marked here. And as we see in our cases, we have deterministic pushdown automaton as the corresponding input symbols that are consumed are different from each other. Okay, so what we need from pushdown automata is that the following theorem, and this is the theorem that gives us the connection between context-free grammars and pushdown automata. Actually, what we need is that for each context-free grammar, we can actually come to a pushdown automaton, which specifies the same language as the grammar. This theorem alone is a little bit dangling around, because it still does not tell us how to do the whole thing. But in the next few sessions, we will talk about how to come from context-free grammars to pushdown automata. There's several ways to do that. There's ways to generate automata that are accepting leftmost derivations, and there's also ones that are constructing reverse rightmost derivations. And those are the ones that we are focusing on the next few sessions. So next time we will continue with top-down parsing. That's all for today. I wish you a nice week, and we'll meet again next week.